Stanley Kubrick Produces provides the first comprehensive account of Stanley Kubrick's role as a producer and of the role of the producers he worked with throughout his career. It considers how he first emerged as a producer, how he developed the role, and how he ultimately used it to fashion himself a power base by the 1970s. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Stanley Kubrick Produces, James Fenwick. James, good morning to you.
Morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Now, we all know about Stanley Kubrick as maverick, iconic director, but just explain to me a little bit about how he consolidated, how he consolidated his base as a producer and why he decided he wanted to take total control.
Yeah, well, I think actually in many ways that's really kind of important to understanding Kubrick, the fact that for him, power, control, and his own image really was kind of central to becoming someone kind of, you know, so kind of iconic within the industry. And it was part of his personality from kind of the earliest days of his career. He was obsessed about kind of gathering control and kind of, you know, being in control of every kind of facet of his film productions and through kind of, you know, into the way that kind of he operated his business companies as well. So for him, kind of control and power was kind of central to his entire worldview.
And I mean, the thing is, of course, I mean, you're looking at a period between, say, Dr. Strangelove, the early 60s, and all through that 70s and 80s period, but more specifically, end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. There's a huge shift, isn't there, about how studios, hire producers and the power base of the studios against the independent producer.
Yeah, and that's something that Kubrick kind of sensed, and he kind of wanted to exploit that as much as possible, particularly in the 1960s, trying to kind of gather control, particularly over kind of marketing and promotion, which often led him to kind of, you know, real conflict with certain studios, such as MGM with 2001 A Space Odyssey, where they were really kind of furious that Kubrick essentially wouldn't let them have a say in the kind of promotion process for that film. And often kind of led to kind of a confused kind of promotion for 2001, for instance. So he kind of sensed the fact that, you know, there was this gap emerging for him, that was an opportunity to say to kind of exploit that gap and kind of take further control of his own productions.
I mean, one of the things is with Kubrick, you could say, though, one of the things was the fact that you could tell he wanted total control because he was making films unlike anyone else. I mean, presumably before, studios are just sort of literally going, oh, well, that director's kind of free, he can work on that project.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the thing though with the book that I found that by the 1970s, you know, he starts working with Warner Brothers, kind of an exclusive relationship for the rest of his career. And Kubrick suddenly had so much control that he could kind of pick whatever projects he wanted and suddenly was faced by, you know, the fact that he couldn't decide what to produce and was struggling. And so throughout the kind of late 1970s and throughout the 1980s, he became obsessed by certain kind of figures within Hollywood, Steven Spielberg and kind of George Lucas, and obsessed with certain films like E.T. And he wanted to produce films like that, these kind of big commercial blockbuster films, but could never quite achieve it. So it kind of worked against him in many ways as well.
But if you look at Kubrick's films before then, I mean, they are regarded as masterpieces, you know, Dr. Strangelove, 2001, Clockwork Orange, but they are hardly sort of blockbuster fare, are they? I mean, maybe The Shining notwithstanding. I mean, a Kubrick film has to be sort of approached with a certain amount of you know, it's not something you sort of like stumble onto on a Sunday afternoon, is it?
No, exactly. I mean, actually, in the 1960s, he was considered a really kind of popular, you know, film director and producer. He was really successful at the box office. Dr. Strangelove, a huge success. Lolita, a huge success. He directed one of the most important kind of films of the 1960s, Spartacus with Kirk Douglas. Again, a huge kind of epic film. And even 2001 was actually, kind of contrary to kind of popular belief, a success at the box office from the get-go. So he was really kind of you know, a popular film director that seemed to kind of tap into the zeitgeist of that period. I think in certainly by the kind of 70s and 80s, he was struggling. And even films like kind of The Shining struggled kind of against kind of other films that were being produced at that time as well, kind of, you know, smaller budgeted films.
And my thing was, if you have that amount of control, or you gain that amount of control, perhaps, you know, he might have done best to have somebody in the studio to say, you know what, Stan, perhaps this is this. I mean, whatever they called him, this is perhaps a better project for you than, you know, some of the ones that he sort of went down blind alleys with.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because again, a part of the myth is that Kubrick could pick whatever projects he wanted, but quite often, particularly at Warner Brothers, there would be figures kind of, you know, at the studio that would still want him to sit down and kind of explain what his project was, and sometimes would kind of push him towards certain projects. So, for instance, in the kind of 1980s and kind of 1990s, they were really desperate for Kubrick to move away from a project called Aryan Papers, which was about the Holocaust. They didn't feel that was going to be a commercial success. And so we're trying to push him towards more kind of blockbuster fare, such as AI, artificial intelligence, which Kubrick initially worked on. So there was sometimes kind of this, you know, pushback from the studios to try and encourage Kubrick towards other projects, certainly.
And I mean, how did he react to, you mentioned directors like Spielberg, Lucas. I mean, that whole new wave of 70s independent producers, new directors, a much more gritty realism, which was kind of what, you know, that Kubrick had done before. I mean, you mentioned something like Spartacus, so, you know, the ultimate sand and sandals epic, sword and sandals epic. But I mean, a film like Paths of Glory, for example, is you know, quite a hard watch even now.
Yeah, I mean, Paths of Glory, I think, is perhaps one of his best films in many ways as well. I mean, it is a really kind of damning indictment of the military as an institution. The kind of reaction to that film across Europe, for instance, it was kind of really extreme. Charles de Gaulle tried to kind of ban it in France. Paths of Glory is also obviously kind of a film that Steven Spielberg, you know, really kind of loves. It's kind of talked about quite often. And kind of Spielberg and Kubrick did develop a relationship towards the end of the kind of Kubrick's life in the 1990s, you know, kind of a kinship almost, and kind of often talking to each other on the phone. I've come across kind of letters and emails they sent to each other in the Kubrick archive, and you can sense this kind of, you know, admiration that they both have for each other's work, despite the kind of differing visions, you know, the fact that Kubrick is this kind of cold, or kind of perceived as being this cold, misanthropic kind of figure compared to kind of Spielberg's childish fantasies. But they still, for some reason, you know, kind of got along.
I mean, it's interesting as you say that, because there is, in Kubrick's films, you know, 2001 and the whole AI and Al and all that. And also, you know, Clockwork Orange, which was, you know, which was banned, wasn't it, of course, for years.
Well, I mean, Clockwork Orange was actually withdrawn. It was never banned. It was withdrawn from the UK. It's a popular kind of misconception, this idea that it was banned, but it was Kubrick that kind of insisted that the film be withdrawn. Around about kind of 1974, 1975, it's not exactly clear when it was withdrawn, and kind of requested that Warner Brothers do that. And that was largely the fact that Kubrick, you know, felt that the kind of reaction to the film had gotten kind of out of hand in the UK, you know, the kind of death threats against him and so on. But that perhaps, again, hints at the kind of control that he did have, the fact that Kubrick, you know, was able to say to a studio, sorry, I don't want you to re-release my picture, Clockwork Orange, in the UK for the rest of my life. I mean, you know, there's not many producers that can actually achieve that.
And I mean, how did he obtain this level of being able to do this? Was it purely through his reputation, the fact that he was making these sort of films, that he was able to take on the studios? Or were it the studios, perhaps themselves? Because the studio system of the 30s, 40s and 50s, you know, by the end of the 60s, that had gone. And as I said before, there were much more nimble producers and distributors who were sort of distributing to this new wave of cinema that people wanted to see. Yeah. Films like Easy Rider, for example.
Yeah. I mean, again, you're completely right. There's kind of contexts, kind of when Kubrick emerges in the 50s and 60s. And it's the fact that there are these kind of changes in Hollywood, kind of dramatic changes towards a semi-independent kind of form of production that he's able to kind of exploit these kind of new conditions. I think there's two kind of elements as to how he managed to get this control, though. One of which is self-promotion. You know, Kubrick loved to kind of contact journalists, often actually start kind of planting stories in the press about himself, you know, some of the more kind of outlandish stories about himself. He wanted to kind of build up this kind of myth, okay, the Kubrick kind of myth, almost. And that was really kind of central because, you know, people kind of were in awe of Kubrick. But the other thing, it was kind of control and information. Kubrick was constantly about kind of, you know, amassing ever more control, ever more information that would allow him to kind of, you know, have kind of every available kind of option open to him when he wanted to make a decision. So he was somebody that was kind of almost a micromanager, if you will. But those conditions also ultimately kind of led to his downfall in many respects as a producer.
So where do you start then when you come to put together a book like this and you know, as Stanley Kubrick produces, and what material did you manage to get your hands on, as it were?
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of this book, it is all kind of using archive sources. So kind of, you know, archives in the USA, the Margaret Herrick Library at Los Angeles, a Stanley Kubrick archive in London, and just kind of looking at production documents, letters, correspondence, and so on. And also really important are the kind of the lost Kubrick films, if you will, the kind of projects that he worked on but never realized. And it turns out there are many, okay? I mean, the amount of kind of creative ideas and scripts that I've come across has been fantastic over the past few years. Really interesting ideas that he wanted to get off the ground but never really succeeded in doing.
So, I mean, do you think, I mean, you think we're looking at sort of the later Kubrick films perhaps, and do you think he was unable to sort of capture some of his former glory? I mean, he had a return to form with Full Metal Jacket, which was an interesting project. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, he only made 13 films across his, which is, I mean, it's obviously more than 13 more than I've made. But, I mean, it's, you know, and then, of course, we had the Eyes Wide Shut, which I said we wouldn't mention off air, but I mean, you know, people do the leap on that one as well. I mean, that perhaps was, you know, somebody should have perhaps reined him in a bit.
I mean, it's a difficult one. Brian Aldiss, the science fiction writer, did think that Kubrick had reached his kind of creative peak by the 1980s. And that, you know, kind of, as you say there, kind of was living off the former glories of the 1960s. I'm not entirely sure, really. I think the kind of the output didn't necessarily kind of decline in kind of quality, but Kubrick himself, certainly as a producer, was struggling. You know, he never was kind of certain anymore about what kind of projects to produce. And even once he kind of did decide on a particular project that really interested him, he just struggled to move it out of development and into production for a variety of different reasons. I think with Eyes Wide Shut, I think he sensed by that point that, you know, he'd got one film left in him. And if he was going to produce any film, it had to be Eyes Wide Shut, a film that had obsessed him since at least the 1950s. So that really was a passion project. And I wonder if in that respect, then the kind of studios allowed him to kind of indulge his passion for that project.
Because it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at the films he did, Lolita, which was supposed to be, you know, the unfilmable novel, and that was, but you know, that wasn't allowed in the UK. And then you look at 2001, which still has people wondering what on earth was that all about several days later. you know, and also the way that he, you know, manipulated some of the material. I mean, The Shining, famously, Stephen King, the author, who knows a thing or two about writing, was hugely critical about what Kubrick did with his book.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, because he often did invite controversy throughout his entire career, you know, starting with the likes of kind of Paths of Glory, the way that I said kind of that film caused controversy in Europe. Lolita, you know, again, controversy of that film as well. Throughout his career, he did kind of court controversy and also have these kind of famous kind of battles with, you know, screenwriters, Anthony Burgess in A Clockwork Orange, kind of Stephen King, as you mentioned. And I think, again, that comes back to the fact that often Kubrick wanted to control and he wanted to make things in his way. And sometimes that would come into kind of conflict with the vision of, say, you know, Stephen King or someone.
So what do you think his legacy is? I mean, you mentioned, I mean, there are very few people, directors, you can mention producers, stroke directors, and people will get them on it. You can say Scorsese. You could argue that there's a man who should have stopped making films 20 years ago as well, you know, because his recent output has seemed to be that of a, you know, going back to the things that he maybe shouldn't have got involved with, yeah. and a little bit of a sort of leering gaze. But also, you know, then you think of Spielberg, you know, and then you think of Lucas and Kubrick, perhaps in the, you know, the auteur way, the way that he produced the look and the feel of his films, unlike any other.
I think that's perhaps, in the end, the greatest kind of impact and legacy. It is the kind of, it's just the kind of iconic nature of his films, the way that they're kind of so ingrained in kind of the, you know, our old kind of, you know, a collective consciousness, if you will, that we remember these images. And I think that, you know, that is really his greatest legacy. And they'll keep kind of being referenced by other filmmakers who are kind of indebted to Kubrick as well. So yeah, I think, you know, one of the most iconic filmmakers of the 20th century for certain.
And James, what attracts you to Kubrick, and what attracted you to this book?
It is all about this, him as an individual, and, you know, the way that he wanted this control. That is what really fascinates me, how he got this power and control, how he used it. And it's also just a desire to kind of slightly deconstruct the myth around Kubrick. You know, to try and understand what he was really doing and how he kind of operated on an everyday level. That's really what kind of interested me with this book. But it goes way back. I've just always had a fascination with Kubrick ever since I first saw 2001: A Space Odyssey as a child. And yeah, it's just a filmmaker that I've always kind of lived with in many respects. His films have always been a part of my life. over the years. So you've been kind of privileged to be able to kind of do this research and write this book.
And I suppose the other thing is, in a world as we are in at the moment, where people are experimenting with all sorts of different media, how to make films, the very nature of how you make a film, you can make a film on your phone, for goodness sake, you know, without and getting them out there without having to go through it, and you can throw it online via various platforms. I mean, that's the sort of thing, in a way, that Kubrick was battling against when he went up against the studio system and said, we're not going to do this. And he, if you like, led the vanguard for, as I said before, all that late 60s up to now.
Yeah, I mean, he was constantly somebody that was, he was an innovator as well, actually, with kind of technology as well. He was constantly, you know, using new forms of technology throughout his career, an innovator in so many respects, particularly with kind of cameras and kind of other kind of camera technology, particularly in the 1970s with films like The Shining, where he uses kind of the Steadicam, one of the first directors to use the Steadicam. So he's always somebody kind of pushing the envelope technologically. And it would have been interesting, actually, to see the kinds of films that he would have made today with kind of today's technology. What would he have done with that? I think he would have done something kind of unique, certainly.
I'm just the mind boggles at the Stanley Kubrick Instagram account, isn't it, really? Let's face it.
Yeah. Well, there is actually a Stanley Kubrick, an official Instagram account, yeah.
That's probably just showing things. I mean, you imagine, yeah. Stanley Kubrick sort of video diaries would be quite something.
Yeah, certainly. The other kind of point I'll make as well is about, you mentioned kind of today's kind of media culture. And Kubrick was, you know, one of those that did one of the first selfies. I'm not saying he invented the selfie, but when he was a photojournalist, he did take some selfies as well that people can find if they quickly do a Google search.
The book is called Stanley Kubrick Produces by James Frederick. It's out now. Is it on Rutgers University Press? It's out, or?
Yeah, Rutgers University Press, yeah.
What do you hope that people take from this book? A better understanding about the rare talent that was Stanley Kubrick?
I think so. I think hopefully it kind of change people's understanding of how he operated as a filmmaker more than anything.
If people want to find out more about you or about the book themselves, we mentioned social media a minute ago. Where can they find you out there in the land of internet?
You can always visit my Twitter account, which is JamesFenwick87. I've kind of got all sorts on there about the book, details about when it's coming out, etc. as well.
Only begs the question, after delving into the life and times and influence of Stanley Kubrick, what's up next for you?
Oh, do you know, I'd love to write a book about Kirk Douglas.
Ooh, yes, indeed.
Somebody that Kubrick collaborated with, yeah.
Well, this book is called Stanley Kubrick Produces. It's out now by James Frederick. By the way, the front cover is absolutely superb.
Oh, can I just point out that the author was Matt Needle, is a fantastic cover artist from Wales.
Yeah. Well, you've just done that. I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, I looked at it and just went, wow, that's that, you know, and down to the tie and the eye is just absolutely superb.
Yeah, it's great.
This book is called Stanley Kubrick Produces. It's by James Frederick. James, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
You too. Thank you, Giles.